Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We will begin with a motion for admission to the bar.
Thank you, Chief Judge Easterbrook. Chief Judge Easterbrook, Judge Flom, I have the honor today to move the admission of my law clerk, Mr. Daniel Burke. Mr. Burke, if you'll come to the podium, please. Mr. Burke is a graduate of the University of Notre Dame, where he received a Bachelor of Arts degree in 2003. And after serving as a Fulbright Scholar and as a New York City Teaching Fellow at the City University of New York, he went to Northwestern University, where he received his law degree and was a member of the Law Review. I'm pleased to say that he will be staying in our circuit and practicing law with the firm of Eimer, Stahl, Clavorin, and Solberg after he leaves us. He has served the court with distinction, and I am very pleased to move his admission to the bar, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, Judge Ripple. Your motion is granted. Mr. Burke, we are pleased to welcome you to membership on our bar, and we wish you many long and successful years of practice. If you would step over to the clerk's desk and take the oath, please.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Our first case for argument is John Doe's 1-9 against the Elmbrook School District. Mr. Lucinitzer.
May it please the court, I'm Alex Lucinitzer for the plaintiff's appellants. Public high school graduates and students of minority religious beliefs, as well as their family members, whose high school graduation ceremonies, events that should have been joyful, landmark celebrations in their lives, were held in the intensely religious surroundings of a church sanctuary.
Counsel, before we get into the merits of this case, I have several preliminary questions. The first of them is whether this case is still justiciable. Since the school district has built its field house and moved its graduation to there, isn't this case moot?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. First of all, the plaintiffs have claims for both compensatory and nominal damages that are
I understand still that, but there are problems with qualified immunity in getting damages. So let's start with prospective relief. Is there any live claim for prospective relief here?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the voluntary cessation doctrine, the claims for injunctive relief are not moot. It is the school district's burden to demonstrate that there's no reasonable likelihood.
Referring to a doctrine that has to do with private litigants, not with public litigants, we ever held that when a public body takes concrete steps, like building a new building that changes the nature of this problem, that the suit is nonetheless live?
Your Honor, I believe the voluntary cessation doctrine affects
both. I know you
both.
Believe that. I have asked a concrete question. Have we or the Supreme Court ever held that when a public body takes concrete steps, changes the nature of its behavior, like enacting a law or building a building, that the case is nonetheless live?
There certainly are Supreme Court cases that have applied this doctrine to a public body, and here the record shows that the school district refuses to commit.
Which Supreme Court case should we look at?
I think let me see. There's that City of Mesquite case. That was a case involving a public body.
Which case are you referring to?
City of Mesquite. I wouldn't have the site off the top of my head, but that's one case associated the Florida case, I think Associate General Contractors. I'm sorry, I don't have all the sites at the top of my head, but I can assure the court that there are cases involving
Maybe we need to do this not off the top of our heads. Now, with respect to damages, this case looked to me similar to the problem in Arizonans for Official English, where the Ninth Circuit once held that a case was not moot, even though Arizona had changed its law, because, of course, it was seeking damages. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, but you can't get damages. Therefore, the case is moot. Right? Well, how can you get damages here?
Sure, two ways. First of all, the plaintiffs asked for compensatory damages. Some of the plaintiffs suffered significant emotional distress, lasting emotional distress, including sleepless nights.
You concede there are no cases on point. So why aren't the defendants immune from damages?
Your Honor, the only defendant is a municipal school district, so there is no qualified immunity when the when the only defendant is a municipal school district. Let me add something about the going back to the viability of the injunctive relief claims. The school district only changed its venue after this litigation was filed. Before the litigation was filed, it refused to commit to using the new field house. And many of the advantages that they claim the church has over various other secular facilities that were available before this new field house was built, many of these same advantages arguably apply to the new field house itself. I mean, one could argue that the church has more comfortable seats, is cheaper, has better parking than this new field house. So if they win this case, I don't think anybody would be surprised if they go back to the church.
Let me look at the same issue that the Chief Judge has raised from a factual point of view. At the time of the class of 2010 graduated, where were the graduation ceremonies held?
The 2010 graduations were held in the field house, Your Honor.
Both of them?
Both of them. The case was filed, however, before the 2009 graduation ceremonies.
I understand. How about the honors ceremonies for the class of 2010? Where were they held?
Your Honor, actually, I don't know if the record even reflects that. The only thing the record reflects was that they intended to hold the 2010 honor ceremonies in on school grounds.
Well, if we decide we need to take a harder look at justiciability, do we have to remand this just to find out where they were in fact held? Do you know where they were in fact held?
Perhaps appellee's counsel can answer that better than I can. I would be surprised if they were held anywhere other than the school grounds.
Is there any indication at this point that anything's going to be held any other place than the school grounds?
Not at this point, as long as the litigation is pending. There's a statement in the defendant's answer where they expressly refuse to foreclose using the church again for graduation ceremonies in the future.
In what document, please?
In the defendant's answer.
And that was filed when?
That was filed in summer of 2009.
Prior to the completion of the...
After the 2009 graduation, before the 2010 graduation.
Before the 2010 graduation, before the completion of the new gym?
I'm not sure if it was formally... I think it was before it was completed, but after they knew it would be ready for the 2010 graduations. So the school district has repeatedly refused to commit to holding to never going back to the church again.
While we're on the question of facts, in your brief you indicate that at least at one time during this litigation, the superintendent of the district, as well as the principal of one of the schools, was in fact a member of this church. Were those men in office at the time that the initial decisions were made to use the church as a place for these ceremonies?
Your Honor, the superintendent was in office throughout the whole history of the use of the church. So he was in office since mid-1990s, and they first started using the church in 2000. The school board president, I believe, joined the board, I believe, in 2005, and I believe he became president in April 2009.
Does the record contain any information other than the fact that these individuals held office when they did, that they in any way attempted to use their influence as church members to bring the school board, to bring these ceremonies to that particular church?
No, Your Honor, it is not. However, the superintendent took a very active role in ratifying and defending this decision.
Are you contending that they misused their offices by steering public business to this particular church?
We are not contending that, Your Honor, but their, especially the superintendent's, role in this decision-making process, the appearance of bias, is one of the factors, one of many factors that communicates a message of endorsement of religion from the use of this particular site. An endorsement of religion is also communicated by what the graduates and family members see when they enter this building during graduations. They see a giant cross and numerous religious symbols side by side with school banners at a school ceremony that takes place in a religious building that is normally used for
more preliminary questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
Before we reach the merits. And what is the justification for anonymous litigation here? If you just think about all the cases you've cited which involve claims of public donations to religion or use of religious facilities, they're all in the names of the real parties in interest. Why is this litigation anonymous?
Your Honor, in establishment clause cases, there has been a history of harassment, violence, physical violence, threats against property, against the plaintiffs. I had a plaintiff in a case involving a prayer at a graduation who was assaulted, physically assaulted by other students after graduation.
I can imagine that, but I'm asking, why is this litigation anonymous? Some of the plaintiffs are, in fact, six of the nine plaintiffs are adults. Some of them are suing as taxpayers. I've never in my life seen an anonymous taxpayer suit, right? Is there any, well, first, what reason did you give to the district court, and what reason did the district court judge give for allowing anonymous litigation? And second, what precedents are you relying on for this?
Your Honor, all the plaintiffs are members of the Ellenbrook community. Some of the, all the adults.
Well, you're not listening to me. Every single case you rely on was litigated in real names. Every single one of them. I have never seen a taxpayer suit that was brought anonymously. I have sometimes seen cases where minors were allowed to litigate anonymously. You originally had three minors in this suit, but they're not minors now. So what cases are you relying on?
Your Honor, we do have minors still. Doe 3 is still a minor. No plaintiff is proceeding solely as a taxpayer. Each plaintiff either attended a graduation or still has students in the school district and plans to attend a future graduation or honor ceremony.
Well,
so that these
have answered my question, what cases you're relying on, nor have you told me what the district judge said when ruling on this issue.
Yes, Your Honor. There are many cases that have allowed plaintiffs in the establishment clause cases to proceed anonymously. For example, Doe versus Village of Crestwood in this circuit, Doe versus Small in this circuit, Doe versus Porter in the Sixth Circuit, Doe versus Santa Fe in the Supreme Court. And, Your Honor, we just filed a motion in the...
Was that a contested issue in the Supreme Court case?
Not in the Supreme Court, no.
Yeah, look, in order to have precedent, you need to have a contested issue. This case will not establish a precedent one way or the other if we don't say anything about it. It's perfectly obvious that parties haven't thought about this. But Rule 17 says litigation shall be brought in the name of the real party in interest. This litigation was not. We've got multiple issues here. We've got issues about whether this litigation is consistent with Civil Rule 17. We have questions about whether this litigation is justiciable, which briefs haven't really discussed either of those issues. So when we're done, we'll be asking you to file supplemental briefs. Now, the merits.
Well, let me proceed with the merits. The use of a religious environment such as what we have here coercively imposes religion on students and family members at graduations and sends a message that the school district favors and endorses religion. Let me address the coercion issue first. The Supreme Court has held that the government may not coerce anyone to support or participate in religion or its exercise. The court applies this principle especially strictly in the public school context due to the vulnerability and impressionability of youth. And the court has held that high school graduation, in particular, is one of life's most significant occasions. And so the event is not a truly voluntary one.
In those situations, the Supreme Court had before it the situation where the public school system sponsored a religious activity itself, i.e. prayer at a graduation, prayer at a football game. In this situation, what you have is a building, but you don't have affirmative sponsorship by the school district of a religious ceremony, a religious activity. Why isn't that an important distinction?
Your Honor, the school district still is responsible for the action that has caused the coercive imposition of religion upon the plaintiffs. For example, in the Kerr versus Ferry case of this court, the reason this was a case involving a religious drug rehabilitation program for prisoners, and it was the prison's choice to use the program, but the prison did not have the purpose of imposing religion on the prisoners. The prison just used the program because it was cheap and effective. So here, the school district claims that it is using this facility because it is cheap and convenient, but the school is still coercing students and family members to enter and be immersed in a religious environment. And even in the Supreme Court Santa Fe case, the school district gave the students the option to decide of whether or not to have a prayer at the graduations. So it wasn't the school district's decision, it was the student's decision, but the school district was still responsible for religion being imposed upon the students.
Let's talk about the so-called information booth. Apparently there were church members behind booths who were available to answer questions. Does the record show whether they took any affirmative action to proselytize as opposed to simply being there? What is the state of the record on that issue?
The only thing we have on record in that was that in 2002, church members distributed religious literature at graduations, but we don't have any evidence of anything like that occurring at more recent graduations.
What about the booths? What was happening at the booths?
We don't have any evidence of the church members stating anything in a proselytizing manner.
Were they there at all of the graduations?
The record shows that the booths were open at all the graduations, and they were apparently staffed by church members.
Do we know what the purpose of having those people there was?
We don't have any record evidence on that.
So there was no attempt to take discovery and find that out?
No, Your Honor. There was no discovery taken in the case. The parties agreed to go straight to summary judgment after the preliminary injunction.
Oh, they did. I see. Okay. So you just don't have the goods with respect to whether there was any affirmative proselytizing?
Not by the church members themselves, but if you look at all the materials that were on display in the church, all the religious symbolism, all the pamphlets
that were available. The school district rented the building for 3 hours or whatever it was. Is it your view that they had to sanitize the entire building of anything that had to do with religion in order to rent it out?
Yes. If such a building is to be used at all for a graduation, it should not have substantial religious iconography on display as a this building did.
Could the school take the children on a bus excursion to a synagogue or a basilica in the area, greater Milwaukee area, that had some architectural significance to let the children see the architectural significance, even though they were also going to see a lot of menorahs and stars of David and Christian crosses and stained glass windows and et cetera in the process? or is it your view that that would be coercive?
The school could do so, but the school should give the students, any students who have a religious objection, the right to opt out of such a field trip. Your Honor, I see my white light is on, so I will reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
I will give you some extra time for rebuttal, but if you have an affirmative argument to make, this is the time to make it.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the coercion point, the main point we would like to make is that the coercive imposition of religion here is more severe, more extensive than what you had in the school prayer cases. In the school prayer cases, students only had to be exposed to a short, non-sectarian prayer that was 1 or 2 minutes long. They could generally leave during the prayers, and they did not have to affirmatively do anything. Here, the students and parents have to enter and remain in a religious environment, be there for hours. The graduation ceremony takes place.
What do you think about the cases that have held that it is permissible to have voting in, say, a seminary? For about 20 years, every election day in Chicago, I went to a seminary to vote, where the polling places were all under a large crucifix. Violation of the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor. Those cases are distinguishable for three reasons. First of all, normally voters, at least in those cases, were allowed to either vote absentee or go to an alternative secular location.
You could not vote absentee in Chicago by saying, I don't like the polling place.
If there is no alternative location or absentee offered.
Everyone has to go to the polling place in his precinct. You can't go to the polling place of your choice.
Then, Your Honor, the question would be, is the area where they vote, is that area have substantial religious iconography on display, or is it a non-religious area?
I just told you what was the case for the standard polling place that was used for my precinct in Hyde Park in Chicago. But that was also the case in the cases that were cited in your adversary's brief from three other circuits. There was a lot of religious iconography. You can't go to a seminary without finding religious iconography. Right? So you just have to assume that that's what was going on. Now, do you think those cases were wrongly decided? We're willing to disagree with other circuits, but you just said you thought your position was consistent with them, and that's what I'd like to hear you explain.
I believe those cases are distinguishable from your hypo. In those cases, you...
I didn't give you a hypothetical. I told you the facts about real voting in the real city of Chicago.
Right. Your Honor, in those cases, at least in the Tenth Circuit case, the areas where the people actually voted were non-consecrated areas of the churches generally where there wasn't a whole lot of religious iconography on display. In the Florida and Second Circuit cases, there was an opt-out. If there's no opt-out in the area where they vote is, the room where they vote is, religious, then there is a very serious constitutional issue.
Well, counsel, is your argument that the temporal aspect of voting is similar to the prayer at the high school football game? So you're just there for a short time as far as opting out?
Right. Well, the voting cases are also distinguishable on two other grounds. One, they involve adults. And so in the Supreme Court applies the coercion analysis and endorsement test more strictly in the secondary school context. And two, it is a more fleeting activity where the voters tend to go in and out as opposed to being forced to remain in the church sanctuary for hours. Your Honor, I see my red light is on.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal when the time comes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Lubinsky.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I, along with my co-counsel, Sarah Beachy, are here today to represent the Elmbrook School District.
Ms. Lubinsky, yes. In the district court, did you contest the plaintiff's desire to proceed anonymously?
We did not.
We tried to find an explanation by the district court for the apparent deviation from Rule 17 and couldn't find any.
I don't believe there exists one. We did not contest it, however.
Now, the law of this circuit is, I think, pretty clear that people have to use their real names unless they are currently minors. Well, that may be true pre-originally of these people.
I believe currently there is one minor.
Currently one minor. Well, that leaves eight.
Yes.
But unless there are minors or there's some other statute or rule allowing anonymity, one litigates in a real name. There doesn't appear to be any statute or rule on which anybody is relying, so I'm surprised that no one has paid any attention to this.
Do you share the view of opposing counsel that the anonymity is required because of the potential harassment in the community?
No, I do not share that view. We never shared that view. However, again, we didn't contest it. It is factually true that we did not take discovery in this case. We felt it was purely a legal issue, and that motion was raised. We chose not to address it. We didn't plan to take depositions of the plaintiffs, and so we just, for strategic reasons, we chose not to address it. Factually, I know the court is going to want supplemental briefing on that issue, as well as the justiciability issue. I do want to address one factual assertion with regard to that issue that is in the record. And I think the distinction counsel was trying to make was that the assertion is the district never came out affirmatively to say, hey, we are never, ever going to hold our graduations back at Elmbrook Church. That's true. We couldn't say that. What we said is we have every reasonable expectation to hold our graduations in the fieldhouse from this point forward. If the fieldhouse were to succumb to a fire or to some sort of event that prevented us from being there, of course we couldn't be there, and we'd have to look for alternatives.
So you would consider using the church again?
The district would only consider utilizing Elmbrook Church or another facility if the field house was unavailable.
My question isn't too complex. The question, Ms. Levinsky, is would the school district consider in the future, under whatever circumstances you set up, using the church?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Yes. So I wanted to address that factual aspect of the justiciability issue, which we'd be happy to brief that issue to the court. The district court in this case, I think, hit the nail on the head, so to speak, when he said that a ceremony in a church is not necessarily a church ceremony. And the court's questions of opposing counsel with regard to the religious iconography, the distinction between this case and those of school prayer cases, they're really summed up in that sentence. This case, as all First Amendment cases go, is fact-based. Your analysis of whatever test you employ to evaluate this case will be driven by the facts. And the facts of this case are undisputed. We have the origination of this graduation coming from students. By the way, students in the gallery, Your Honors, from the school district, the AP honors class.
I don't understand what the significance of that is. In the Supreme Court, there was a case in which there was prayer at a graduation because the students wanted it, and the Supreme Court said the fact that the students wanted it is neither here nor there. So why should the fact that the students wanted this be of legal significance?
Because in that case, the court analyzed the prayer under a coercion analysis and did not employ the
exactly. But it had nothing to do with whether the students voted for the prayer.
I agree.
And therefore, what the students voted for here shouldn't matter.
It matters under an endorsement analysis, Your Honor.
Unless the students were part of a concerted activity by the church to get the graduation moved to the church.
Agreed, which has no basis in this record.
We have no idea from the record, do we, Ms. Levinsky, why the students wanted that facility?
We do have evidence in the record. We have evidence in the record that the idea came from students, and it was because of the existing facilities of the two gymnasiums, specifically the lack of air conditioning, the tight seating, the lack of...
I understand the comfort analysis.
Okay.
I guess my inquiry is, are we to read the student preference, the student's preference, as that they would go anywhere which is more comfortable? They didn't designate the church particularly. In other words, they would pick anything that was better than the existing school facilities?
What I can tell you is the record is clear about how the selection was made. The field was narrowed to two or three locations.
Who created the list?
It originated with the senior class officers, and then the vote was taken of the senior class from the 99-2000 school year. And so the answer to your question is there was a narrowing process. There was then a vote. Elmbrook was the overwhelming majority. That decision was, in fact, made by the principals of the schools, and then the superintendent let that decision stand. Opposing counsel tried to suggest that factually true that the superintendent was, quote, in office, end quote, for the entire time. That's certainly true. There's absolutely no evidence in this record that the superintendent had anything other than to let a had any involvement other than to take no action. That is anything but the situation that I think the appellants are trying to suggest, which is that because we've got a superintendent who is a member of the church or a school board member, this didn't even go to the school board. Those are facts that have no relevance in this court's analysis. They are facts, of course, that became relevant in a district court case out in Connecticut, where the board in that case was heavily involved and, in fact, had communications with the religious institution and were working, the district court found, cooperatively to have the event at the religious place. There's no evidence in this record that those facts have anything to do with this case, and I want to dispel that notion right away. As to the court's concern about, coercion versus endorsement, the court should be mindful, and I think this was apparent in the argument of appellant's counsel, there is simply no appellate court decision at the Supreme Court level or at any court of appeals level finding that the viewing of religious iconography alone constitutes coercion. And I would like to point out that there are scenarios that I think the Supreme Court of the United States has actually noted as being even more prevalent. You go to the United States Supreme Court, and the clerks who sit there every day in and day out, and the attorneys who argue before the court day in and day out, are forced to view very symbolic religious symbols in that court. They exist in government buildings all over.
I don't understand that, counsel. There's a frieze around the Supreme Court courtroom that contains Moses. It also contains Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
And when a Muslim group asked that be blotted out, Chief Justice Rehnquist said, these are portraits of lawgivers, and they have no religious significance whatsoever. Are you telling us that Chief Justice Rehnquist didn't understand the significance of the friezes in his own courtroom?
No, but I would also cite, Your Honor, to the decision in the I believe this was the Salazar case, where the court said, quote, a large statue of Moses holding the Ten Commandments alongside a statue of the Apostle Paul has overlooked the rotunda of the Library of Congress in the Jefferson Building since 1897. It goes on to talk about medallions on tablets depicting the Ten Commandments.
There are no worship services in the Library of Congress.
And there are no worship services in the Supreme Court, just like there were no worship services in the Elmbrook Church.
One can debate the question to which some people have elevated the Constitution into a civil religion. But
the dominant physical nature of those buildings convey something other than what the church conveys.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the fact that this is private property is even more a compelling factor I think the court should look to in the endorsement analysis. In a public building setting, putting the Ten Commandments on the public building versus in this case, all these kids know they're going to a public school. All the parents who go to the graduation know they put their kids through public school. They know what they're going to. They're going to a graduation event that's held in a religious facility, a private property. And even Kennedy, in the recent decision, talked about the fact that...
Justice Kennedy.
Justice Kennedy, I'm sorry.
Yeah, your brief, you folks forgot the justice's title, too. It's Justice Kennedy.
And in the Salazar case, Justice Kennedy said, quote, as a general matter, courts considering Establishment Clause challenges do not inquire into the reasonable observer perceptions with respect to objects on private land. And so, in fact, Your Honor's correct that in those cases it's all on public land. And the court looks to, for example, a religious display on public land. In this case, all of the religious iconography was on non-public land. And everybody who went to that graduation knew why they were there. So it's for those reasons.
I probably should have asked this question of your adversary. But with respect to endorsement or similar issues, I mean, one would think the first line of defense would be a disclaimer in the graduation program, disclaiming any connection between the school district and the church or the church's symbols. Is there any such thing in the program? Was there any such thing requested in connection with this litigation?
I can tell you the record is devoid of any reference to it being there or not being there. If you want me to tell you what I know to be the case,
I'm interested in what the record is.
The record shows no evidence one way or the other.
Was there any request in this litigation that the school district ensure that such a disclaimer be present?
There was none.
You've covered an awful lot of ground in very little time, but if I may interrupt once more, tell me your side of the, first of all, the one incident of proselytizing back in 02, and secondly, these information booths. That's the soft underbelly of your case. And I think you really ought to, frankly, address it with us.
I think opposing counsel correctly stated the record in that regard. The record does indicate that there was, for at least one or more years, I don't know that the record says all. I would have to go back. But there were booths at the Elmbrook Church that were staffed. There is no evidence in this record that there was any proselytizing by any member of the church. In fact, all of the evidence in the record shows that what occurred in the entryway, if you will, of the church was the handing out of programs done exclusively by members of school staff, parents, and students, not necessarily seniors, some sophomores, juniors, but all of the activities going on there, this record shows, were non-religious in nature. It is true that there were pamphlets on some years that might have been visually present. We're not suggesting that's not factually true. There was attempt early on to remove things that were portable, stands, if you will, holding pamphlets. Later on, those things were not removed. That's factually true.
How about the 02? See, there was the 02 incident. They said there was one person who apparently tried to hand out religious literature.
I do not know if that's factually true in this record. I'd have to look at my record.
Do we know what those people were doing there? In the information booths?
The record is devoid of any indication of what the intent, purpose, or other activities were that were going on. Oh. We know they were manned, and that's all we know, unfortunately.
So it was nefarious. The fact of the matter is that never was developed.
Correct. And again,
is there any signage by the school district indicating on that day, either on the lawn or even in the interior of the church, that this is graduation 09 or 08? Is there a banner? I'm not saying a banner has to cover the cross, but I'm suggesting, is there anything to set apart the physical venue or at least identify temporarily that it's holding a unique event?
There is in one sense, and that is the jumbotrons that are on the wall, the front wall of the auditorium, displayed the graduation ceremony, and I believe, I'm fairly confident the record shows that until the videographer got going, the pamphlet, the leaflet that's given to folks as they come in was shown. So whatever would be on that cover would be there. There was not a banner.
No. I'm trying to see whether your case is aided by a disclaimer that this is other than a graduation for the given year. That's all. I mean, if you were to go to many high schools, there might be a flag that says this is X High School. Mm-hmm. I just wonder whether there's any symbolism brought from the school and planted on the stage. Maybe, was there an American flag there? There perhaps was, I don't know.
I guess I can only answer that question, unfortunately, by telling you that I think the record does not indicate whether there were or were not.
Well, you know, in a fact-intensive case, it sometimes helps to have discovery. I appreciate both sides feeling that this was a solely legal issue. But
sure.
I think earlier your argument you spoke to it being fact-intensive. So in that regard, let me ask you about your private-public separation. This court occasionally sits on private property. We go to law schools. This is, First Amendment cases are interesting cases. Do you think it would be appropriate to save some travel time for those students if we held this argument this morning at the church? Would that be at all coercive for opposing counsel, let's say?
Let's assume
it wouldn't affect
so.
The judges. But, would the public interest be served if we opted to hold court at the church and heard the argument we're hearing this morning? Do you think that would make the public generally comfortable to come and hear the argument, as comfortable as they would be coming into this building, let's say?
I don't know whether the public as a whole would be as comfortable. The analysis that must be employed in that scenario would be, does holding court in a religious facility have the effect of coercing mm-hmm. religion or endorsing religion?
Right.
And my answer to those two questions would be no.
So we would not be. If we regularly held court in religious settings, that is, edifices, That would have no element of coercion for the public generally.
You added into that one that I didn't hear before, and I may have misheard the concept of regularly holding. I thought you were talking about for an event, going to a church.
Well,
for
we go
a
to
case.
Law schools. We go to law schools mm-hmm. in this circuit and hold court, and we don't exclude the public, although obviously mainly the attendees are faculty and students, but. And
some of the law schools have religious affiliations.
Affiliation, exactly.
And icons.
Yeah. My answer to that would be no. By merely holding your argument in a facility, be it a law school, a church, or whatever, that has religious iconography, as long as what you are doing in the time you're there is doing what we're doing here today, which is not advocating, advancing, or otherwise endorsing any particular religion, just because there may be a cross on the top, on a wall, or on the carpet, doesn't render what you're doing unconstitutional.
Do we have to decide that question to decide your case?
Well, Your Honor has raised some justiciability issues that I think are preliminary issues in nature, but I think ultimately if you reach the merits, the court needs to decide what test to employ, and I believe under either test, especially the endorsement test, which we believe is the appropriate framework, you need to determine whether the religious iconography, which is the only religious element in this case, has the effect of endorsing religion.
What I'm saying is, do we have to articulate a rule in this case at a level of generality that would cover both the educational ceremony like a graduation and core processes of government taking place in an ecclesiastical setting?
Not only do you not need to do that, but you shouldn't do that. And may I briefly answer your question?
Sure.
The United States Supreme Court has cautioned against bright-line rules in Establishment Clause cases, and so I would answer your question by saying, no, you don't need to, and no, you probably shouldn't, in the sense that these are fact-intensive cases, and while I recognize Your Honor's concern about some of the facts that you've raised today, the facts of record, we, the litigants, were comfortable arguing on those issues. But no, I think you need to address these facts in this scenario.
Ms. Levinsky, I noticed we had a list of other sites that have been discussed in this litigation. Would you say if the graduations that were had at the church were had at Midwest Airlines Center, Miller Park, or let's say the Wisconsin State Fair Park, that there is no difference in the ambiance, I'm speaking now of the coercion aspect, of holding it at those three sites versus the church? If you're of a minority faith, minority in what presumably is a Christian community in Brookfield.
There is a difference kind of in the creature comforts, and I'm not sure
if
that's what you're asking.
I'm assuming that the alternate sites had may not have been near or might have been more expensive. I'm just taking sites that, let's try to get a hypothetical where they're more commercial, but they do carry the brand name or the state's name, that the church setting is significantly the same.
I think that there are available alternatives. We're not here to suggest there are none.
No, no, I don't want to speak to the possibility. I just want to speak to with you for a second about the setting. Is it your position that for the limited time, 2 hours or whatever, that there is no significant difference between that setting and a setting, let's say, some distance apart, but has is a more of a commercial nature rather than a religious nature?
Well, the only difference is the religious iconography.
Right.
I mean,
well,
you know,
that's why
we're here.
Right.
So I'm not going to answer Your Honor by saying, no, there's absolutely no difference. There is a difference. However, that difference, in our view, is one that doesn't raise constitutional concerns.
So an educator or a decision maker here, being the superintendent or the principal, I forget the title of the final decision maker, need not factor that in because the temporal aspect is so short. So that if the field house is not available for the next 5 years, there should be no question that the use of the church is appropriate.
Well, let me answer that question in two parts. Number one, I think that if the field house is not available in the next 5 years, they're going to have to employ an analysis at the time under the framework that exists at that time. The fact, our position is you can't exclude the church solely because it's a religious facility. That, in our view, would bring this case actually, turn this case on its head, and actually be the government stepping in and getting too involved in religion.
This school, this church holds itself out as having a facility that can be rented in the community.
And they do rent.
Does the record indicate the other entities that rent this facility?
No. All the record indicates is that this district, as the years unfolded, it became more and more difficult to get the Elmbrook Church, and they literally had to rent it out for the graduation the day after the graduation, i.e. 364 days in advance because of need. But to answer your question, no, I can't tell you from this record that X school or Y business rented out the facility. It is available for rent, and that is in the record.
Do we have anything in the record to indicate any other school district in the state, for example, has used religious facilities for this purpose, graduation? Does the record indicate that?
The record does not indicate that. And I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Lukenitzer? We'll give you 2 minutes, and then we'll see if there are more questions.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me try to address some preliminary issues first. First of all, in response to one of your first questions, there is a Supreme Court case that did apply the voluntary cessation doctrine to a school district, the parents involved with community schools case cited in our brief. Second, with respect to the issue of anonymity, we would argue that the school district has waived that point, and we have also – we filed a motion this morning asking that a document containing the identities of plaintiffs that was just filed in this court be kept under seal. And so that document does provide briefing on that issue, although we'd be happy to brief the issue further. Also, with respect to what they'll do in the future, in the past, the school has regularly relied on student votes or votes of senior class officers, and certainly the students or officers could easily vote to go back to the church in the future, regardless of whether or not the field house is available. On the merits, Your Honor, the school district's point that the coercion test should only be applied to a religious exercise is a we think is calling for the court to draw an illogical distinction. I mean, there's no reason that religious messages received with the ears should be treated as covered under the coercion test, but ones that are provided visually or forced immersion into a religious environment should be deemed exempt. In Lee, the court said law reaches past formalism, and there's really no logical basis to draw the distinction that the school district wants to draw. And in terms of the argument that, well, this is a religious message of a private party, both the Supreme Court's and this Court's coercion and endorsement cases have applied both tests to religious messages of private parties. I mean, that was the fact in Allegheny, Santa Fe, Marshfield Burger. So I see my red light is on. Your Honor, does the Court have additional questions?
Look like it. Thank you very much, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement. The Court gives the parties 14 days to file supplemental memoranda addressing two questions, justiciability and the propriety of anonymous litigation. So we will look forward to your memos within 14 days. Thank you.